This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Welcome to Desert Island Discs, where every week I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, the book and the luxury item that they'd want to take with them if they were cast away on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music on these podcast versions is shorter than in the original broadcast. You can find over 2,000 more editions to listen to and download on the Desert Island Discs website. My castaway today is the opera singer Danielle Denise, a diva fit for our times. Her lyrical performances and charismatic presence have made her a star. One somehow gets the feeling that she was always headed for the top. As a young child, she won singing competitions in her homeland of Australia. And once the family moved to America, she had, at 15, her professional debut with the Los Angeles Opera. Just 4 years later, she was gracing the stage of the Met in New York. But her big break came at Glyndebourne. And if it were not the stuff of public record, it would frankly sound made up by a Hollywood scriptwriter. In 2005, the soprano scheduled to play Cleopatra fell ill. In stepped my plucky castaway and stole the show. It would seem she not only wowed the crowd and the critics, but the owner too. She later married the man for whom Glyndebourne has always been the family home. She says, when you share your interpretation of music, you are bearing your soul to the audience, transporting them to a different place and time. You give people part of yourself, and you need to be willing to take the risk to be truly great. That sounds terrifying.
It does sound terrifying.
Is it?
It is terrifying in that thrilling way. I get nervous and I often think, you know, why do we keep doing this to ourselves? Go back out into the lion's den, you know, to the stage, this great unknown. I mean, there's so many things that can happen.
You have said also that fear is a big part of singing and so is faith. What do you mean by that?
Well, because I feel fear when I sing. Not all the time. It's funny, it's a sort of paradox that lies within me of the stage is the most natural place that I can be. It's where I give everything of myself. But I get fearful about things before I go on. But once you get on stage, I'm in the service of the character. So I'm no longer in the service of myself.
You're all in then, obviously.
Yeah, I am all in.
We were getting a cup of tea made for us, actually, as we sat down and I said, you don't take milk, presumably you don't touch dairy. And you said, oh yeah, sure, I touch dairy. In your real life, you're not too precious about real life. I mean,
no,
about catching colds or about all that sort of stuff.
Well, I hate catching colds. But it happens and that's kind of what vocal technique is for. Because, you know, the amount of days that I've had in my career where I've woken up and been in perfect voice and uttered my first note and gone, wow. It's here today. I'm going to sound great today. Five, a handful of perfect, perfect performances, you know, where everything worked out the way I wanted. And technique is there for every other day.
What has been your premise for choosing your 8 discs today?
Well, it took a while because music is my whole life. So my whole life is a soundtrack and I'm always attached with headphones. You think about actually landing on a desert island as a castaway. And you never see anyone again. And this is all you have. And so in a way, it is your life.
This is music that would sustain you.
Yeah, this is music that would sustain me, but also music that I actually do want to hear on repeat 1,000 times over.
Tell me about your first disc then, Danielle Denise. What are we going to hear?
I grew up in Hancock Park in Santa Monica, was where I went to school. And it was the 90s. It was the time of life when you could love pop music and you could love rap music. You could love Alanis Morissette and you could like Snoop Dogg. This band called the New Radicals had this amazing kind of pop candy kind of song, of which the refrain says, you've got the music in you, don't give up. This world's going to pull through, one dance left. And it closes out by saying you only get what you give. And I just love this song. It's become a sort of like a mantra for me. And I have it in my headphones all the time, sometimes before going on stage. I mean, my dressers, when they rip out my headphones, they're like, what are you listening to? But it gets me in the zone. They call me the Michael Phelps of opera because Michael Phelps always has his headphones on.
Sure.
I'm like that. And
let's hear it. The New Radicals, You Get What You Give. You strike me as the sort of person, in everything that I've watched, I've watched a few documentaries, I've obviously listened to you in preparation for talking to you, that wouldn't necessarily be interested in, how can I say this politely, a middling career. you're always aiming for, you know, for the top.
Yeah, my mom told me, dare to dream. She always used to say this, and I had this little picture above my bed. And she definitely instilled in us that we couldn't be on Earth without having big dreams. You know, she used to say, God gave everybody a talent and we have to discover what yours is. And she firmly believed this. And I felt so lucky that I'd figured out what mine was so young because I had their support and I had their nurturing to help me to uncover that. And it's definitely what I want to do with my son too, is, you know, help him to discover what he loves.
When you come off stage, are you energized by what you've been through or exhausted?
Energized. Generally, after that, I'm up for hours with just the remainder energy of that kind of like radio wires between me and the audience.
Tell me about your second disc.
Evergreen is one of the very first songs I learned with my mum. And to try to describe what my mother did for me, this is the ultimate gift in a way when you consider what profession I took up, which is that she taught me the difference between singing and interpreting. And she taught me that music is so much more than ink on paper. And it's what you do when you take those notes off the page that makes music. And I remember her singing this song for me. And I only know her version. Funnily enough, listening to Barbara Streisand's version, I kind of went, that's not how my mother sang it to me. Because she made it her own. And I learned how to think in that way from the way that she sang to me. And she applied that to every song she taught me. And this was one of the first ones. I can still hear her and see her singing and interpreting and phrasing certain parts of this song, Love, Ageless and Evergreen, that they'll just stay with me forever. And if I hear this song, I'm 8 again, looking adoringly at my mum.
Love, soft as an easy chair. Love, fresh as the morning air. One love that is shared by two. I found with you.
Barbara Streisand, Evergreen. Danielle Denise, you have a really interesting cultural heritage. Your parents are Sri Lankan, but you were born in Australia.
That's right.
So how did they get to Australia? What happened?
Well, my parents moved separately when they were young students.
Ah.
So they met in Australia. My parents are mixed with Dutch and Scottish heritage. So they're called Burghers, B-U-R-G-H-E-R. And it was quite a common move that the Sri Lankan Burgher population, which only made up about 5% of Sri Lanka's total population, did, because English was their mother tongue and they grew up with British schooling, Western clothing. My mum is a Presbyterian, my dad is a Catholic. So they had this colonization, commonwealth existence, which went away when Sri Lanka was no longer a colony. And
right.
So this was a very common thing, to go to the commonwealth countries where they felt more at one with the culture.
And you've described so beautifully, as we went into that last piece of music, your mother singing to you, that music was in the house, it was part of life.
Yes, it was always there. And my mother sang to me as a baby. I heard these cassettes, they used to record these things. I could copy what she was doing.
What age were you when you first performed, as it were, when you weren't just in the kitchen singing with your mother?
6, 5. I went to the Johnny Young Talent School, and Johnny Young was, I guess, like the Simon Cowell of Australia, but he was a big talent scout and had a show in Australia, which was a bit like Australia's Got Talent.
Was it a competition then?
No, it was a, like
just
a talent school. So
okay.
It was a talent school. And by 8, then I did Young Talent Time, I won the Talent Discovery of the Year, which was...
What did you sing?
A Whitney Houston medley of The Greatest Love of All, and I Want to Dance with Somebody, in super fabulous matching color-coded outfits that my mom had handmade for me, which was amazing.
What did you win?
A grand piano, which I still have.
Oh, wow.
And $5,000. And, you know, that's a lot. So
yeah.
It was amazing.
Tell me about your next disc, Danielle Denise. This is your third.
So my huge idol as a child was Dame Kiri Takanawa. And my parents would say to me, you know, Kiri is from the Southern Hemisphere. Kiri is from a mixed background like you. And Kiri is singing all over the world now. So if Dame Kiri can do it, you can do it. And that's all I needed, was just one role model. You know, I already had one in my mother. So then to have somebody who was actually accomplishing their dreams that I felt close to was amazing. And this recording was one I've heard my whole life. And it's this, to me, the sort of the bar of everything great. It's beautiful singing. She has one of the most beautiful voices that's ever come to earth from God. And I was lucky enough to study with her as well and meet somebody who was my idol. And after meeting them and working with them, and made me idolize her even more.
Mozart's Mi tradì quel alma ingrata, sung by Dame Kiri Takanawa there, with the Paris National Theatre Opera Orchestra, conducted by Lauren Mazel. Your whole family then uprooted themselves, Danielle Denise, and moved to LA. Was this to support your talent? Was this to give you room to grow in a city that could give you what you needed?
That was a big part of it. And
that's a big deal, isn't it?
It's a huge deal. I mean, yeah. My parents cashed in their retirement. They sold their house. You know, this was once we decided that we were going to stay in America. This was a huge move. And it's an amazing sacrifice they made for me to continue my training.
Yes. So your training by this time, you were around about 11 when you moved.
Yeah, 10. Yeah,
10, 11.
I'd sort of done everything I could do in Australia, which sounds insane, right? I was 10 years old. So, but I'd won every iStudford in Australia up to age 18.
And just to be clear, because one of the things I was wondering is, you know, you went to LA, of course, it's the home of the pop industry, really,
yeah.
And great music is made there. You went to a performing school where I'm guessing there was
the
singing
Colbert
and dancing.
School, yeah.
And you had chosen opera by that point because it was original, because other people weren't trying to do it? What was the reason?
Yeah, it was a combination of feeling it was the most natural and lovely way to sing, and I was able to do it naturally, so it felt easy, and I felt it was special. I've always been stimulated by it, and I love it, and I'm lucky. I know how lucky I am because of the amount of friends I have around me that I know had mixed relationship with music and fell out of love with it. Because, you know, a music career can be really tough. There's a lot of, you know, as many troughs as there are peaks, and those knocks every one of us has to get back up from. It's not easy.
Let's hear more of the music you love, Danielle Denise. We're on your fourth disc of the day.
This is such a funny song. So Australia has a summer for Christmas. Sri Lanka, where my parents come from, is a hot country. So one of these Christmas things that we would have is this Calypso Christmas Carols by the DePaul Chorus. And this is such a funny song. We loved listening to this song as a kid, Andrew and I, my brother. It's so funny. It's about a guy who goes doing the Christmas rounds. And, you know, he keeps stopping by friends who say, you know, stop for a drink at my house. There's 12 rum bottles. And he does. And he gets in so much trouble with his wife, Sally. And it's called A Christmas Present for Sally. But he gets in so much trouble because he lost that present. And my dad, like, adored this song. And him and my mom would laugh about how much trouble he'd be in if the same thing happened. And it reminds me of the very unusual nature of my particular upbringing, where, you know, a lot of different kind of cultural influences, and I feel the heat of the Christmases that I remember when I hear it.
Well, he started home about 3 o'clock, and he mind his walk carefully, or the joyous Christmas is gonna be with a present for he wife Sally.
Yes, I started home with a holly tree and a present for my wife Sally. As I passed the house of my friend Chauncey, he up the window and called to me, "Would you pass my door without scarce a knock, while the sun's so high before 6 o'clock? I've got 12 rum bottles lining up the shelf. 'Tis Christmas Eve, come and help yourself." So
Christmas present for Sally, the Duport Chorus with Hamilton Grandson. How do you keep a performance from becoming stale?
I just pretend it never happened before. I go on stage every night and I always say to myself, this day never happened. It's so easy to go on autopilot.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
I just don't.
I know this, I've sung it, this is my 20th performance of it, blah, 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 blah. No.
I can't do that. I just put it in my mind that it's, that never happened, or that the Count never said that to Susanna until that day. That day is always today.
You know these paparazzi shots that people so enjoy reading in magazines, where they say, well, you think she's glamorous, but look at her when she's out at Walmart, or here she is getting into the car, taking her kid to school. And, people look like normal. Our stars look like normal people. You know, they're not wearing makeup and they're in their sweatpants. They got their Birkenstocks on. I've never seen a shot like that of you. Are you ever like that?
Thank heavens.
Are you ever undone?
Sure. I mean, I live at Glyndebourne, you know, where there's 30 guests that make the Glyndebourne operas come alive, stay in the house. And I've had the odd moment. I remember one of the earliest ones I had, I came bolting down the stairs with wet hair and I saw Sir Charles McCarris on the stairs. And we just made an album together of Mozart. And so, you know, we're two professionals who have seen each other in a professional situation. And there I was with a wet head of hair. And I remember feeling odd about it. And I remember him looking at me oddly because I was not dressed in the way that I normally am. Mm. Yeah, I have my undone moments.
I mean, living at Glyndebourne, that is something to live up to. I was watching a documentary with you in it, and one of the final shots was you walking across this grand lawn outside this grand house, and I think you had at least one or two beautifully manicured dogs.
The bulldogs.
And you were swishing in this fabulous dress. It's something to occupy that space, to be the sort of chatelaine of a great house like that. Do you feel that that's something that you've learned to be, or did you always feel at home there?
I think I just accepted what it was to live there because I fell in love. So I haven't changed, I don't think, at all as a person, or I certainly didn't kind of go, well, what's the job description of chatelaine? So, you know, I must now go and swan around the house or something. And it was something that definitely the press did project onto me, you know, the idea of the American coming in and changing all the curtains and redecorating and, you know, all that kind of thing. And
right.
I'm not interested. But that's because I fortunately have the great strength of having my own job. I have my own career. And so I don't feel the pressure to come into a place like Glyndebourne and go, right, I have to leave my fingerprint everywhere so that people know that I'm here. I'm doing all of that fingerprinting on the stage so I can just be happy and be in my surroundings. And we've definitely got a few letters from people who've stayed there who have been amazed at how warm and fuzzy the whole place is in terms of its atmosphere, not in terms of the way that it's changed or anything. And so I think that's a good testament to our family life.
Some more music, Danielle Denise. We're on your fifth.
This is a duet from Les Miserables. And Les Miserables and me have this long history. I was one of the two finalists to play Cosette when the musical first came to Australia. I didn't get the part. I then sang for Johnson Lyft, the casting agents who cast Les Mis on Broadway every year in Los Angeles when they visited, since I was 13 years old. And every year they'd say, how old are you now? How old are you now? And just after I turned 18, I got a call from them asking me to come to New York while I was still finishing high school and sing the role of Eponine on Broadway, learn the role and be in the ensemble. And so I got permission from my school to go for two separate stints of about 3 weeks each, along with my physics homework in tow. And just continued this amazing love of Les Mis. Eponine is a beautiful role. And this duet fascinated me from childhood, also because it's got a death in it. And I was fascinated by what it would be like to die on stage.
A little fall of rain can hardly help you now. I'm here. That's all I need to know. And you will
I'll
keep
stay with
me
you
safe
till you are
sleeping. You will keep me close.
A Little Fall of Rain from Les Miserables, performed there by Francis Raphael and Michael Ball with members of the original 1985 London cast. It was composed by Alain Boublil, Claude-Michel Schoenberg and Herbert Kretzmer. And I had the pleasure, our listeners sadly did not, Danielle Denise, of you singing along there towards the end. I've spoken to, actually it tends to be actresses mainly who say this, that as their career has grown and grown and grown, and they know that people are buying the ticket to see them, you know, you're no longer the unknown. People are buying that rather expensive ticket to come see Danielle Denise because, you know, she's really fabulous. Does it feel worse before you go on stage, that sense that you know that the audience is there for you?
Yeah, it doesn't feel worse, but it's a shift that happens in your career because when you're at the beginning, you have no burden of expectation.
Exactly.
So you go out just fearless and you feel comfortable leaping because there's no other place except to get to the other side. And when you become more established, you get that. I heard she was so great. Let's go and see if she's that great. I try not to let that become a thing that makes me change. Because, you know, there's another really fine line when it comes to performance, which is that if you try too hard, it becomes this thing you can almost smell from the stage.
You spoke about the fact that you, you know, you started your work as a singer so young and you were an 8-year-old and then a 15-year-old and on it went, and on it went. One of the greatest changes physically that you've been through now is pregnancy.
Mm.
When you were pregnant, presumably you had to stop singing at some point.
I did. I stopped around 7.5 months. In the last month of pregnancy, I lost my voice altogether.
Really?
Well, I sounded amazing. I sounded like this very sexy, husky James Bond kind of character. James, you know, I was thrilled with that. But I couldn't sing. I just couldn't sing. I sounded like I had laryngitis. And I saw the doctor and he said, go have your baby and come back in 3 weeks. And of course, I knew that in 3 weeks after the birth, supposed due date, I was due to start rehearsals at Glyndebourne.
3 weeks?
Mm.
Ambitious?
Yeah, totally ambitious. I couldn't say no to it. And I thought, if the baby pops out in time, I'm not giving that up.
Let's fit in some music. Tell me about this. This is your sixth.
My husband's going to crawl under a rock if he hears this. This is a song by Coldplay. It's called Swallowed in the Sea. And it's playing on, you know, those programmer things that you program the music into, or it plays on shuffle and it comes out through a speaker system. So it was playing on a programmer the night my husband kissed me for the first time. It's Coldplay, so it's not like something really Glyndebourne-y, you know? And there's a line in it which says, I could write a song 100 miles long. Well, that's where I belong and you belong with me. And it's just gone right to the center of my heart. And I think it's a good song for a desert island too, right? You belong with me, not swallowed in the sea. I was floating around in the water there, about to go to my death. I think of that moment.
And I could write a song 100 miles long. Well, that's where I belong, and you belong with me. And I could write it down or spread it all around, get lost and then get found, or swallowed in the sea.
That was Coldplay and Swallowed in the Sea. Your husband can come out from under that rock now. He's safe. It's not cheap to go to Glyndebourne, Danielle Denise. You know, there's always, as there has been for a very long time, the conversations that surround what are broadly viewed as the elite forms of art, you know, ballet and opera and so on, that, you know, most people can't go. They can't afford it, even if they wanted to go.
Opera is expensive to put on. It's one of the most multimedia experiences when you consider that you've got, you know, a stage production, you've got the values of a play, you've got crew, you've got a much bigger orchestra than in a musical, you've got huge casts of singers, and then you have all of the different métiers of prop making, wig making, makeup design that go into creating these characters, you know. And you don't have a soundtrack to play. There's musicians, 60, 70, 80 musicians that have to come in, plus a chorus. So there's a lot of people that have to take a paycheck home to put on an opera. And the great thing is that we have these super passionate supporters of opera who are wealthy, who many times step forward and say, I'm going to cover this bill so that somebody else can buy a ticket for 30 quid. And Royal Opera House has got that scheme. Glyndebourne has its under 30s where you can get a ticket for 30 quid. So these things are there. But I do recognize that it's a really normal preconception to have that you can't get in and it's too expensive and all that. And those tickets are there, but there are ways to get in.
More music, Danielle Denise. This is your seventh. Tell me about it.
This is particularly personal. I picked this piece because I was listening to this a lot when I was pregnant with my son. And I was in this kind of serene state of calm. And I definitely had in my mind, hold on to this. I became slightly obsessed with this piece and I love Rachmaninoff. I love hearing this because it has a very sweeping sense to me of everything that is warm and good in my life. And I remember feeling that way, that sense of nurturing, that sense of like really caring about something that was almost as fragile as cotton, you know, and you try to hold it and you don't have to do much to hold it, but you have to figure out how to cradle this thing. And, you know, when life is inside of you, it's just, I just remember that feeling. This would remind me of that.
Part of the slow movement from Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto in C minor, performed there by Lang Lang with the orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatre, conducted by Valery Gergiev. I get the feeling as I've listened to you talk about your list today that you really are genuinely one of those castaways who's thought quite thoroughly about what it'll be like to be cast away on a desert island. How do you think you'll cope?
I hope that I would find the inventive ways to survive. Be like Tom Hanks, you know, when cast away and make a spear and start eating sashimi. I caught a tuna fish on my honeymoon and I remember saying to Gus, the only thing I want to take to a desert island is wasabi so that I can have some sashimi because I can catch tuna with my wooden spear.
We'll come to your luxury in a moment. There's one question that I really do want to ask you because it has been such a trajectory for you over the years of all your hard work in your career. Do you have an ultimate goal? Do you think if I do that, I know that I've reached the pinnacle?
I don't have one goal. I want to share my passion and exuberance for classical music, do other things and do those things while being a classical musician and promoting classical music. So do other things in order for people to say, wow, she's passionate about this thing and she's an opera singer who does that. And I want to let people in to the power of music, that it is a transformative experience. And we've slightly gone on a little bit of a tangent in terms of classical music becoming less mainstream than it used to be. And it's nobody's fault. It's just mainstream music has changed a lot. And my experience of having been a television show host, having done musical theater. So my whole life has been a sort of yin-yang of opposites, of living both inside and outside the classical world. And that's why my greatest thing that I can do is just be my absolute true self and put myself in places where if people connect with me, they'll go, I connect with her. I understand her, who she is as an artist. I want to know more about her and I want to know her music. Oh, she's singing opera? Great, I'll go see that. That's what I would love to see happen, that it opens up people to the possibility that classical music can be just as beloved to them as any other kind of music.
Let's have your final track, Danielle. Tell me about this.
I didn't know whether to choose this, but I chose a track of my own, not because I love hearing my own voice, which you know I don't, but this is a really interesting moment in my career. I made my fourth album, Beauty of the Baroque. I chose this because it reminds me of this moment when I got the first edit of the disc. And I was in New York with my parents And we sat around the kitchen table and we put it in the CD player and we played the whole edit. And this was, I think, the last song. And I was listening to this. It came on, and this is a song I've known since I was 6, 7 years old. You know, we had Kathleen Battle or somebody like that, you know, singing this in the house all the time. And I listened to this track of myself, which is already like a cringeworthy experience when you're an artist, because all you hear is everything that you didn't do. But I had one like moment. It was like a little like sun ray that came through all the other judgment I put upon myself. And I heard this and I actually liked it. And it was the most amazing moment for me personally to hear something and kind of go, I might be okay.
Was Bach's Sheep May Safely Graze, sung by my castaway, Danielle Denise. She was accompanied by the English concert conducted by Harry Bickett. How was it listening to it this time? You managed to enjoy it?
Just a nice memory, you know, the one and only time, you know.
I'm going to give you the books, the complete works of Shakespeare.
Great.
And the Bible, or what every castaway gets, and along with it, they take one other book. What are you going to choose?
I kind of went with my very first instinct, which was one of my favourite books when I was a kid, which was The Great Gatsby, which is a kind of melancholy book, actually. But it's sort of melancholically beautiful. So that's why I thought I could take it to the island, because I would read it again and again and find new colours and new shades of melancholy. And I really love that book.
We shall give you that. You're allowed a luxury. I don't know if it's going to be wasabi based. What are you going to choose as your luxury?
This was hard. You know, I was thinking about whether I would choose something that's scent orientated to remember my loved ones. But of course, scent runs out, right? So then you just end up with a dirty rag of sorts or whatever. But my very first thing that I thought of was that I would take a slide projector. Because I remember when I was a kid, my dad would, you know, all the photos were on slides. And mom, dad, Andrew and myself, we would sit and this, he'd pull a screen down and we would have these amazing slideshows. And we'd look at all these pictures of things. And if I could have a magical slide projector that had all the photos I've taken over my life and sit there on the island under the stars and just reminisce, if I could just see all my loved ones, everything else I could do with my mind, music I will always hear. So, you know, and smells I can remember, but I would probably look at them every night and they'd become like works of art where I could find new details in these slides.
You can definitely have that. Now, this is a very unreasonable thing that I'm going to ask you to do. If you had to save...
Oh, that's right.
I know.
One.
Just one of these discs from the waves. Which one would it be?
Which I haven't thought of yet. Probably I would choose Evergreen. It's one of my youngest memories, but it's also, it kind of describes my whole life because love is so important to me. And, you know, my love for my husband, my love for my children, my family, and love is ageless and evergreen. And that is something you'd want to have circling around you at every moment when you're alone, because, you know, being alone is a terrible fate, I think. So to have that, I'd probably save Evergreen.
It's yours. Danielle Denise, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Kirsty, so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Desert Island Discs. You'll find over 2,000 interviews with artists, musicians, scientists, sports stars, comedians and more at bbc.co.uk/Desert Island Discs. And I have a favour to ask. If you could rate and review the Desert Island Discs podcast wherever you download your podcasts, it'll really help other people find us. Thanks again for listening.
This is the BBC.
This is a story about a man called Otto von Wächter. He was Austrian, a lawyer, a husband, a father, and a very senior Nazi. It's a story of life and love, and of a curious death. You could say it's a sort of mystery story. Otto Wächter is a Nazi you've never heard of, because he escaped justice. I'm Philippe Sands, and I'm going to take you on an unexpected journey to find out what actually happened to Otto Wächter. It's a journey that goes right to the heart of something called the Rat Line, the Nazi escape route out of Europe that started in 1945. Along the way, we're going to meet an unlikely cast of Nazis, fascists, assassins, spies, sons of spies, lovers, murderers, and an elderly man who lives alone in a castle steeped in family secrets, who I've come to know rather well. To subscribe, just search for Intrigue, The Rat Line, wherever you get your podcasts.